Testing.
Right.
One, two, three, testing.
Okay. And who you are and where you're from?
My name is Donald Nolan. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. And I was attached to the 93rd Engineers on the Alcon Highway.
Would you tell me how you happened to join up and what your family did and how much school you'd had when you got in?
I was one of the first from Maryland to be inducted in the service. And I finished high school in Baltimore, Maryland. And I had been out of high school about 3 years or 4 years prior to being inducted into the armed forces. I entered the service October 13, 1941, before Pearl Harbor. And it so happened that the day Pearl Harbor was bombed, I happened to be AWOL because I got homesick and came home the following Saturday. And I was stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is the engineer school. And at that time, we didn't have U.S. Route 95. We had 301. And the fellows became homesick, and they came out on the road of 301, and we caught a truck home. We saw this farmer, and he brought me all the way into Baltimore. And I think it was about two or three others who were with me. And after he brought us into Baltimore, he gave us some fruit, apples, and whatnot. He said, good luck, fellas, and I hope you'll be back home soon. So my mother woke me up that Sunday morning and told me, she said, Donald, Pearl Harbor was bombed. The Japanese bombed the United States at Pearl Harbor and we were at war. She said, you better listen to the radio. I listened to the radio and they stated all military personnel who was away from their home, away from the military base, go to your closest army installation, and from then on, they will provide you getting back. So, Pennsylvania Avenue at that time was an area where largely black people went for entertainment, and it was a large black section. So it was several army bases, I mean several army installations there. There was the Navy, the Army, just Navy and Army. At that time, blacks were not accepted in the Marines. It was just the Army and Navy. So I went back and got on this truck, the truck taking me to Fort Meade. And Fort Meade, from there on, from Fort Meade, we were loaded, put on Army trucks that were going to parts of Virginia. And that's how I went back. But I really wasn't AWOL. I just got homesick and came home. And from there, we went to Fort Livingston, Louisiana. And my outfit, which was the 93rd Engineers, had been just activated at that time. After we had gotten our gear and equipment and things together, We were loaded on a train. We didn't know where we were going, but we were headed north. Now, this was in Louisiana. We came through quite a few states. I think Mississippi, Arkansas, quite a few other states heading north until we arrived at Tacoma, Washington. At Tacoma, Washington, we were put on this big troop ship.
Do you remember the name of it?
No, I can't remember the name of it. And I do know one thing that stands out in my mind. The water was awful rough up there and cold. And the food was very delicious. The food was magnificent on the ship. But they didn't inform us not to eat too much. So we got into this rough water. I think I was one of the sickest I've ever been in my life, seasick. I was so seasick, the whole trip, all of us just laid and upchuck and vomit and everything. We just laid there. We were so sick. And what happened, the commanders made us come out of our where we were sleeping in the troop compartments, made us come out and come up on the deck to get fresh air and to take some calisthenics. But most of the men were so sick they couldn't even move. But by coming up excuse me, and getting fresh air and whatnot, we did feel better. And getting the food out of us. And we later on we were told that we shouldn't have eaten too much. But the fellas just, you know, good appetites and everything. So we finally went to our destination. And I think we started at Dawson Creek, Alaska, in Dawson Creek. And we worked our way north. And that's when we started the road.
Now, do you remember where you got off the boat, where you actually got off the boat?
You said remember?
Yeah.
Where it was?
Because, see, Dawson Creek is way inland. So you took the boat from Tacoma north.
Yeah.
That's okay. You somehow got to Dawson Creek.
Got to Dawson Creek. And that's where we set up our housing facilities. And during that time, it wasn't extremely cold, because I think when we arrived there, it was just about the spring of the year, because Pearl Harbor was bombed in December and winter. And it practically lapsed about 2 or 3 months. So we'd say we were going into maybe about March, February, March. And we didn't run right into the extreme cold weather, but we had a chance to adjust to the weather, because it was spring of the year. And then when the fall came, we had been working on highway, but we didn't have sufficient clothes, because the Japanese had control of all of the North Pacific. We were in the North Pacific waters. And the Japanese had been there for years and years and years on those islands, and they had posed as fishermen. And they had control of these islands, and naturally, they had sank quite a few of our supply ships. But we still got supplies through, because they came through Russia. And at that time, I think it was the Russian Beslan. And I do recall my outfit, the 93rd, sent details down to these Russian ships to unload them with the few supplies we were getting in. And I vaguely remember that they had these Russian women on the ships, and they were working just like men. And a lot of them were large women, and they were handling lumber. We got a lot of lumber because they had dressed lumber, not the raw trees and things. It had been dressed 2x4s and whatnot. And I remember we going down and loading up the lumber and other supplies, bring them back to for distribution to our outfit. Well, during that time, I was working in the field with my company. And this, now I'm saying this was warmer weather. We had chance to do, to gain a lot of road because the ground was dry and it wasn't frozen. So a lot was accomplished during the winter, I mean the spring and summer months. Because up there, it's 6 months of daylight, 6 months of dark. And I found that out. So anyway, I was still working in the field. But one day, an officer that was happened to be, I can't remember his name either. He was an officer over our platoon. A platoon is made up of three squads of men. Three squads of men is a platoon. One squad consists of about, I think then one squad was about 9 or 10 men. So you can multiply that by 3, 10, say 30 men in a platoon or more. So a platoon leader came over to me and he called me. He said, Private Nolan, he says, I want to speak to you a minute. So I came over. I had picks and shovels. We had a nickname for picks and shovels. We used to call them the ignorant sticks. Picks, shovels, stuff like that. He said, drop your pick, and he said, drop your shovel and come with me a minute. I'm going to talk to you. He says, I have, oh, ready? Okay.
Well, I'll catch you later.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3.
Tell me who you are.
Who are you?
Walter Parsons.
And tell me where you're from and what your background was, and then what unit you joined and where you went.
I'm from Bryan, Texas. That's in the central part of Texas. There's where Texas A&M is located at College Station. The two cities are right next to each other. During the war, I was with the 97th Engineers. I volunteered for the 97th. Not that I wanted to be in that regiment particularly, but I was part of a group that wanted to be together. And some of them were from California, and some were from New York, and some from Pennsylvania, and I was from Texas. And so we figured if we went someplace that was a long way from each one of our homes, why, we would be assigned to the same place. So we all selected Florida.
How'd you get this group? How'd you meet all these people?
I was in a refresher course, 8 weeks refresher course in Virginia. And
Officer
refresher course. This was before the war, and I had gone into the service because I had an obligation for serving, and they were calling reserve officers in for a year, and I had something that I wanted to do, and I had this thing hanging over my head, so I volunteered to get my year over with. And that was in May, and then had Pearl Harbor in December, so they canceled all the promises they'd made to let us out in the year, and they said they let us out when the war was over. So that's how I got with these people from the other places.
And your group pretty well stuck together?
We did until we had finished the highway. And after we finished the highway, I left the organization to become a part of another organization that was just beginning a project there in Alaska. It was called the Canhole Project. And we had a problem with that project because it was a petroleum type construction job, and there were not many people who had experience. I had had 10 years with the Exxon company, and so I was one of the most experienced officers they had there. So I was put in charge of building the refinery.
What unit was it? What group were you assigned to?
The Northwest Service Command, but it was the White Horse District of the Corps of Engineers. There were a lot of enlisted men and units assigned to this project, but they were not there where we were. They were up hauling pipe and hauling construction material and stuff like that. But at White Horse, we were building a refinery, and there were very few enlisted men there, and there were very few officers. Most of the people that were under the construction there were contractors, civilian contractors.
Now, let me back up a little bit and tell me about where you went on the Elkan before that and what your assignment was.
I was a regimental adjutant when we left Florida, and I was put in charge of the second echelon, or the second train. We had two train loads going out there, and I was in charge of the second train. They called it train commander. See? And we went from Florida to Seattle, Washington by train, and it was in the springtime, and it was lovely weather until we passed through the Rocky Mountains. And when we passed through the Rocky Mountains, it was snowing. But it was 2 o'clock in the morning, but one of the boys woke up and found out it was snowing, and he woke the whole train up, and they opened all the windows that they could and let the snow blow in the train, and they had snowball fights, and it was the first time that some of these boys had ever seen snow. They were from Florida and Georgia and Alabama, and they'd never seen snow. And they didn't realize that they were going to see plenty of it when they got to Alaska. So they were playing in it there on the train. We got into Seattle, and we were there about 2 days, and we camped at a stadium, a football field, had our tents all pitched out there on this football field. And the night before we were supposed to leave at 5 a.m, the colonel went to dinner with the port commander, and the port commander asked him, who are you leaving here as a rear echelon? And he said, well, I didn't know I was supposed to leave anybody. And he said, yeah, if you don't have somebody here who is interested in your getting your supplies and equipment and everything, he said, you may not get it. So he became very excited about that, and so when the dinner was over, he came back to camp. I'd already gone to bed. They came over and woke me up, and he sent for me, and he said, Captain, he says, we're leaving for Alaska in the morning, but you're not going with us. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because I'm leaving you here as a rear echelon. And I said, what is a rear echelon supposed to do? And he said, I don't know. He said, whatever they're supposed to do, that's you, see? So at 5 o'clock the next morning, the boat sailed for Alaska, and I stood on the wharf and waved goodbye. I had no idea what I was supposed to do or anything else. So the next 6 weeks, I spent a lot of time getting equipment and everything shipped to Alaska. It was very difficult because we had there too, the longshoremen and everything were all civilians, and they had rules and regulations. And one of the things that I remember was that we had half tracks or with machine gun racks on them. This rack stuck up kind of high, and they put the vehicles in the hole, and they push them forward, and that rack would keep them from going over all the way. And so they were losing a lot of space. And I told them, I said, well, just take that rack off and lay it down in the vehicle, and we'll put it back on when we get there. And that way you can get more vehicles in here, or they can't take anything apart. So I said, here's four bolts down here. You just take this loose and lay it down. Well, I came back an hour later, and that one vehicle that I'd taken this thing down was in there. The rest of them were all standing up. You know what I mean? And so they said, all of them were welded, except that one that you showed us knew was bolted, and the rest of them were all welded. And I said, well, look, just take a torch and burn it off. Oh, no, no, they couldn't do that, see. So I had to go and get instructions from the port commander there to get them to burn that off. It didn't make any difference to us because we had welding torches and everything, and we just welded back. But they didn't know that, see.
And there was a problem with the mail, too.
Huh?
You said there was a problem with
mail. And the problem with the mail, because the APO, or the Army Postal Office, was keeping it a secret when the boats would be leaving, and they wouldn't tell the people at the post office. And the people at the post office bring the mail down there, and if there was a boat leaving, they'd take the mail and put it on it. But if the boat was leaving tomorrow, they'd just tell them there wasn't any boat leaving, and then the mail would go back to the post office. And before the post office found out about it, the boat left. And that went on every day. The boats were going and leaving. The mail was running up and down the street. So I had to go to the postmaster and talk to him and talk to the port commander and get them together. Did I knock that off?
I got an idea.
They would work together on the thing and get the mail up there, because I was getting telegrams every day. What happened to the mail? What happened to the mail?
So the port commander was right. They did need a rear echelon.
Well, if you didn't have a rear echelon, you wouldn't get anything, see? And so after 6 weeks, I had most of the stuff shipped up to us. And I then asked permission to join the regiment, and I went up on the troop ship. Well, I had to pay my own expenses, you know, in the 6 weeks I stayed there. I had to pay for all my own meals. I could have eaten with. And when I got on the troop ship, since I was supposedly traveling on orders, which I didn't have, and was supposed to get per diem, that made me pay for my meals on the troop ship. And I never did get reimbursed for this, because our communication after that was just, the commanding officer wrote to the port and said you should have issued orders. The port wrote back to him, said you should have issued the orders, and they argued about it until it was too late, see. But anyhow, I joined the regiment. By this time, the regiment had gone into the interior, and all that was left there was what they had been unloading from the ships, and so they put me in charge of staying there in the port now and shipping the stuff up the highway.
And you were with the 97th and
97th.
What division of them?
97th Engineers.
And then what, was there a company or a division or something? Or just?
The 97th is General Service Regiment.
Okay.
And we were a part of the northern section of the Alaska Highway. But we never did see those people. They were down in Whitehorse.
Okay. Great. And so you got stuck with Valdez for a while.
Got stuck in Valdez for another 3 weeks. And by that time, they had so much confusion up on the road there that one of the captains broke up or had nervous breakdown or something, and so they put me in charge of his company. So I went, then I went into a different company than I'd had before.
What company was that?
I had C Company at first, and then I became battalion adjutant, and then I've had F Company.
Okay. And on the highway, you had trouble getting supplies up there. I was particularly interested in what you said about the PX.
All of our food and items like that that were not military type things, you know, were shipped to us by civilian shipping. And the civilian drivers would buy cigarettes by the case. And sell them to the soldiers along the highway. At that time, cigarettes were selling for about $1.10 a carton. But these fellows were charging the soldiers $5 a carton for them. So while I didn't smoke, I didn't think that they should take advantage of the troops that way. So I took up a collection from the officers there, and each one of us put in $100, and we sent an ambulance to Fairbanks and bought $400 worth of cigarettes, and then sold them for about 10 or 15 cents a carton more than we paid for them in order to accumulate some interest. And after two or three trips to Fairbanks, well, I was able to give the officers their money back, and we had a fund there. Now, I wouldn't tell you this 50 years ago because it was against the law. You couldn't run a PX sort of thing like that. It just wasn't allowed, see. But we did, and with the surplus money that we got from the thing, we bought pencils and paper and radios, and we bought a number of gasoline lanterns because we didn't have any gasoline lanterns, and when our generator would go out, and it went out quite often, well, we'd be in the dark, and so we couldn't get these lanterns, and so we bought them from the PX money.
Well, I was interested in what you told me about finally wiring them after none of your supplies came through for a long, long time.
That was kind of a joke there, but we weren't getting supplies. And after a few days, I sent a telegram and told them to cancel all requests for supplies and send me 125 wooden boxes for caskets. And that got their attention. And so they... But although we got truckloads of supplies, we had trouble with the enlisted men who unloaded these trucks because the things that they didn't like Vienna sausage, instead of loading it off the truck towards the mess hall, they'd throw it in the snow on the other side of the truck, and nobody'd ever know the difference. And so when spring came, I'm sure there were just lots of cans of Vienna sausage.
What did they call those Vienna sausage? They had some funny name for them.
I don't remember now what they called them, but we got a lot of it. As a matter of fact, that's the only kind of meat that we did get.
Yeah.
Except when we'd kill a bear or something like that, well, we'd have some meat. Or I killed a lot of spruce hens. A spruce hen is a very dumb bird. And if you came home to a tree with 8 or 10 of them, and if you shot the bottom one, and it'd fall down while the rest of them would just sit there until you shot out, I don't know. But if you shot the top one first and it fell down through the rest of them, they'd all fly. But they were so dumb that you could just start at the bottom and they'd all sit there until you shot all of them. I carried a 22 caliber rifle with me all the time, just for that purpose, shooting spruce ends.
You have some material on the court-martial, which interests me a great deal. The court-martial, would you tell me a little bit about that?
After I left the regiment, a detail from the company that I was in was transferred to another company, and they were with that company for a while, and then they were supposed to return to their original company. And at the time they were supposed to return, it was about 35 degrees below zero. And the sergeant tried to get them all to get on the truck there, and they put their bags on the truck. But the truck it didn't have a canvas on it, and it had been sitting outside, and it still had snow and ice in the truck bed. And so these boys refused to get on there. They sent for the lieutenant that was in charge of that group, and he came out there and read the articles of war to them and told them that it was a mutiny to disobey an order like that.
Their sergeant would have been black.
All the sergeant was black, see, and everybody was black except this one white officer that was there. So this white officer drew a line in the snow there, and he said, "I'll just give you 10 seconds to cross that line if you're going to get on that truck. Otherwise, I'm going to charge you with mutiny." Well, nobody stepped across the line. And it was really unfair because in 10 seconds, you can't make up your mind to do anything, you know. And 30 degrees below, they didn't even realize what he was saying. And he charged them with mutiny, and they sent them to White Horse and put them in a stockade. Well, by this time, I had been transferred to this Cannell project, and I heard that they were in the stockade there, so I went down to see them. And they asked me if I would be the defense for them. And while I didn't know a whole lot about it, but it was a common thing for officers to act as a defense counsel. So I didn't replace the people who were assigned, but I worked with them, see. And we had this trial, and these boys were found, with the exception of one, were found guilty. And in certain degrees, depending upon the information that the sergeant said about some of them got on the truck and some of them didn't get on the truck and they got off and that sort of thing, they had sentences from 3 to 18 years.
How many of them were there, do you remember?
There 11. And one of them only got free. And that boy had, before the lieutenant came out, had gone to the latrine. And he was in the latrine when the lieutenant gave him the order to cross the line, see. And so when he came back, they just threw him in with the rest of them. And nobody asked any questions, and he didn't know what they were doing, and so he went along, but he wasn't guilty of anything, I mean.
Well, you had a pretty good defense idea, I thought. What was your argument that they shouldn't be sent up?
Well, our primary argument was that this was against the regulations of the regiment there to put people on an open truck when it was below 30 degrees. The only problem was that this was a verbal order and not a written order, so I couldn't produce any thing in writing that said that was, but
it was a verbal order that they weren't allowed to do that, see. But the people who were on the court, none of them had been on the highway. These people were assigned there in White Horse, and they were assigned to projects like building the refinery and doing that sort of thing. And they didn't know the hardship that these kids had been through up there on the highway. And they didn't know black troops. I mean, they had never been assigned to black troops before, and or they weren't even assigned to them then. And there was a war going on, and they just didn't want to have any foolishness, and so that they found them guilty.
Would you tell me the difference between the troops you commanded and the usual white company? What kind of differences did you find?
Well, I had never commanded any white troops until I was a full colonel. When I was a full colonel, I hadn't commanded any troops since I was a captain, because I'd been on ROTC duty and other assignments, staff assignments, see? And so when I finally got back with troops, I had an engineer group, which consisted of several battalions and that sort of thing. Well, I really didn't have any direct command over anybody. There were lieutenant colonels and majors and captains all in between me and the troops.
Maybe a better way to ask is what were your black troops like? What would, you know, what kind of people were they? Did they have much education? Were they willing?
The black troops did not have much education. The ones that were educated were young, timid type people who had stayed in school, you know, and graduated from high school. And there were a few of them. One of the criteria that we had for selecting non-commissioned officers was to ask them whether they'd been in the Boy Scouts. And the reason for that was that we knew if they'd been in the Boy Scouts, they knew how to camp, they knew how to cook meals out in the open, and they knew how to tie knots and rope and that sort of stuff. But there were very few black boys that had been in the Boy Scouts. But every time we found one that had been in the Boy Scouts, we promoted him.
What about reading and writing? Did you set up schools, or did some men help the rest of them? Or?
Many of them could not read or write. But it really wasn't a big handicap, I mean, for some people. For some people who can't read or write, they pay attention to what's said, and they know that they are not going to have an opportunity to read it, so that they retain what they hear. And that was one of the characteristics that I found of the colored boys that could not read or write. They listened well and retained what they heard.
How was the morale?
The morale was pretty high, because we were headed south. There were other regiments that were headed north, and they didn't know where in the world they were going to, but our regimental commander had told our troops that as soon as we met the regiment to the south of us, we were just going to go right on down the road and go back home. Now, that wasn't a fair thing to do, but that's what he told them, see. And so their morale was every mile they went, well, they were headed south, see.
And you were there when they actually did meet.
Our regiment and the regiment south of us was the last regiments to join, to meet each other. The others had all tied in by the time we got there, so that when our regiment met the 18th Engineers from the South, that completed the highway. And so I went down there. I was about 50 or 60 miles from there back. And I went down there to be there when it happened, see? And the picture that I gave you, oh no, I didn't give you, I'll send you one, of these two boys shaking hands over the bulldozer. One of them was from the 18th Engineers, the white boy, and the black boy was from the 97th Engineers. And although many of the black boys in the 97th were from the South, it just so happened that that one was from Pennsylvania or
And you actually mustered the photographer who took the picture, and you know his name.
I took
him
down.
On the rest. Let's put that on the record.
His name was Richard Howell. You check that now from
right.
The article that I'm going to give you. I think it was Richard S. He was a roving editor for the Engineering News Record. And he took a picture of the two men that drove the cast. And then he took a picture of two officers, one from the 97, one from the, that were shaking hands. He published both the pictures. And then he took a picture of all the officers that were standing there. I have that picture too, and I'll send you that picture too.
About moving the.
Oh yeah, the two cats met in the woods, and it was right at sundown, or it was almost hardly any light at all. And so we didn't think we could get a good picture. And we moved the cats back about a half a mile, quarter of a mile maybe, to a creek where the trees were back away from the water and made more light there. So really the picture was taken about a quarter of a mile from where it happened, see. Part of the thing, see. There used to be a Catholic priest that roamed up and down the highway, and he would say Mass wherever he went, and I'm a Catholic, so he would stay in my camp, and there were a few Catholics, but not many. Among the black people, there aren't many Catholics, but there were a few, and so this priest would say Mass. Well, this black sergeant would come over and say, "Captain, can he have service for us?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "I'll ask him." So I asked the priest. I said, he was a civilian. Now, he wasn't a military man. I said, "Would you conduct a Protestant service for these boys?" He said, "I don't know how to conduct a Protestant service." I mean, he was a fellow that had never been around Protestants at all. I mean, he just raised in the Catholic Church. And I said, "Well, if I tell you how, would you do it?" "Well, yeah," he said, "I'll tell you how." I said, "Well, what you do is read from the scripture and just read a little bit, maybe for about 5 minutes, and then we'll sing some songs." And I said, "You don't have to worry about that. They sing their own songs. And then when they get through singing a song, you read some more, and they'll sing some songs." And he said, "Well, I'll do that." So we'd have Mass, and then the priest would conduct the Protestant service, and they liked that, and they all sang their songs, and they led their own songs, and the priest got an education, and they get their service.
Some of the preachers like Carol were so educated beyond the rank and file that they didn't relate real well.
Yeah.
And
educated both of them. We educated the priest. My hometown was Palestine, Texas, East Texas, and we had lots of colored people there. I knew lots of colored people before I went into the service.
Did you, some officers told me they took kind of a hard time from other officers, white officers, who had white troops, that they felt they were superior to officers who had black troops. You ever run into that kind of?
You mean we thought that some of the officers didn't respect us because we were with black troops? I never worried about it. Nobody ever said anything to me. If they had, they I'd have said something back to them, see, because, no, I don't think, they may have, see, but nobody ever said anything.
How did you handle discipline problems? If you had, anytime you have numbers of people, black, white, men, women, groups like that, you have infighting among each other, how were...
That was an interesting thing, because you have a disciplinary problem, you got to punish somebody, you got to do something. See, we're too busy working, we're moving from here to here, we had no stockades, no place to put anybody. Some soldier would act up and get homesick or did something, get bad. We'd put him in a tent by himself. Well, he thought that's fine. I mean, everybody else had to work, and he wasn't being punished. He was in the tent by himself. So then we rolled the sides up on the tents, you know. If he got outside in the sun, he could stay warm. But if he stayed in the shade, you know, even, you know how it is there. Sometimes it's warmer outside than it is in the shade.
Yeah.
So we rolled it. But he still wasn't being punished as much as the guy that was working on the road. And you couldn't punish somebody and make him work on the road, because that was what all the rest of them were doing, is working on the road. It was a problem. It was a problem there, see. And you didn't have time to fool with that sort of stuff. I mean,
did you ever figure out anything that was particularly evil?
No, we just postponed it most of the time. Postponed it, see. I had a lieutenant that was my exec when I was a company commander, who was from Long Island. And one night he was officer of the guard, and I was officer of the day. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we get called down to stockade there because they were having a lot of noise and stuff like that, and the ones that wanted to sleep couldn't sleep. And so they line them up all out there, the sergeant did, see. And we just stood outside there. So they picked out the ringleader. Of course, you could tell who he was. He was talking more than anybody else. And they're going to put him in a box. There was wasn't big enough where he could lay down. It wasn't big enough where he could stand up. He just had to sit down in the thing. So they put him out there, and I went with him, and so did this lieutenant. Well, after they got the boy locked up in the box there, he looked up at me and said, no, he looked up at the lieutenant, see? And he said, Lieutenant, he said, well, you won't be like that. He said, the captain can't help it. He meant, because he was from New York and I was from Texas, that I had to be mean, see? He said, but he wasn't blaming me. He blamed the lieutenant for being like that, because he didn't need to be that way, but I couldn't help it. Some funny things happened while we were in the service.